Thanks very much, Dean. I'm Oliver, I'm an addict. It's great to be here. Really, really good to hear you, QT, home. Almost as soon as you started speaking, I could feel myself lighting up with identification, which is exactly why I come to these rooms. That identification is like an absolute elixir for my soul. It snaps me out of my kind of egocentric isolation, which I tend to spend way too long in. And so, you know, it's quality, it's priceless. And as soon as you describe that sense of being in active addiction and being trapped in that glass box and that eternal scream that can never be heard, I knew exactly what you meant. I'm feeling it right now. And what I found in these rooms is beyond words. I'll do it my best effort to describe the experience of coming here, acquiring freedom, transmitting that freedom, helping others acquire it. It's mind-boggling to consider how my life's transformed since I've sat in these seats, almost a decade now. And one of the things I felt pertinent and that I wanted to do was to dedicate this year to someone that we lost quite a while ago. Last time I shared here, I think there was a girl celebrating a day clean just over to the right there. Her name was Emma, and she'd been a few years clean when I first came around. Relapsed, was really struggling to get clean, and yeah, it was kind of, you know, on and off with the prescription drugs, and got a day or two together, and it was like really fierce to celebrate that with her here, and then we lost her a little bit later. So as soon as Dean invited me, I considered that, and I considered the gravity of reasoning that brings me here. As I said right at the beginning, I'm Oliver, I'm an addict, and I feel deeply grateful to have developed a deeper understanding of what that means to me personally, because it gives me extra motivation to keep coming back and engage with this process. I think when I first came here and I said, I'm Oliver, I'm an addict, all I truly meant was, I'm Ollie, I've used loads of narcotics and I've smashed my life to pieces. It's ugly out there, I'm frightened, I'm alone, I'm depressed, I'm thinking about killing myself. I can't talk to any friends, I've got no family left, and I'm worried. I'm worried about where this is going. And if I'm brutally honest with you, I was like that a few years into my addiction. I started when I was like 14. I was in rehab at my family's terror by the age of 16. I had no clue what was going on. I came out of that rehab. I continued to use. I found myself in suicidal despair at 19, and still quite an innocent youth, and running with people who were really desperate addicts, who really were prepared to do almost anything for the getting and using, finding ways and means to get more. And I still had like an ounce of morality in my soul, and I was like, wow, what we're up to is, you know, sinister, and it's frightening, and this wasn't how I saw it going when I first took them first trips and leapt through the doors of perception. I didn't see this squalor coming, and that's how it got really fast. And the people I was with were quite brutal. There was no code of conduct amongst us. I was bullied because I was one of the younger of the herd. I'd got a private prescription. I was being chased down for any spares, any bits and pieces that I'd left over. And I was hiding out in a bedsit. I'd been homeless for a few years, and I reached out to my family. I was like, I can't do this. I really, really can't do this. So I started to experience what I heard other addicts describe as a rock bottom. I'd already, at 19, reached a place where I was prepared to say, help me. Help me, I can't do this. And unfortunately, I have a disease that's cunning, baffling, insidious. All the things it says in forms of literature, all across 12-step recovery, and the way it isolated me with ideas that it was substance specific. My problems, my life issues were all to do with certain substances. And so I entered a decade of trying to control and manage and manipulate my using. And the power of denial that Kitty spoke about was, despite my life getting progressively worse, I always believed I'd be able to use my way back to some nostalgic vision that I'm not sure ever really existed. And I always thought, you know, I can get this under wraps, I'm sure of it. I can get it back. I can snatch, you know, victory from the jaws of defeat. I can, don't make me let go. And the grimmest thing was I'd been in treatment centres all throughout my 20s, and all of them, whether they were 12-step or not, all of them were singing the song of abstinence, and I was like, it's deep, and why would you even put that on me? And eventually, you know, my life deteriorated really, really quickly towards the tail end of my 20s, and there was like a relationship breakup, there was me street begging, there was opportunistic theft, there was again running with a herd of people I didn't recognise or relate to in any way, shape or form, just other grotty, feral addicts, and just felt like, wow, how is my life like this? And kind of surrendered, I guess, to the idea that that's just how it was going to be. And so going to bed every night promising myself it's going to be different, I'm going to make it change tomorrow, that started to wear thin. And then the idea of, oh, just end it all, and that even was like a tired echo when I was just in this kind of freeze frame purgatory, cash machines, mile of Hackney Road, dealers, stairwells, people I didn't care to have any form of conversation with, and eventually bottomed out. And I bottomed out in 2006. I was sent to Pentonville, and I remember it really, really vividly. I was in the cell, and I just felt crushed and humiliated and dirty and destroyed, and I said a very sincere prayer from that cell. Deeply atheist man, sat there kind of crying internally and just screaming out from the roots of my being to the spirit of the universe, just save me from myself and this awful situation. I can't go on, and I can't find any other route. And what happened then for me was, I guess, an early experience of transformation. I was prepared to reach out and ask for help. I'd arranged a 12-step rehab as like a prison dodge. It was an option I was looking into to just swerve going down. And I reached out to the team in that prison and was speaking to them about, hey, I've got this rehab, I think I might have a place there, can you see if it's still available? And they did, and it was. And everyone on the landings like really came down hard on me for exploring that option. Everyone was like, what are you even doing? You just do your bird, you get back out and you crack on, and that's just the way it is. Yeah, I was just like, no, I'm done. And I really, from the roots of me, I meant it. I'm done, I'm sick, I'm tired of feeling sick and tired, all the stuff I'd seen on prison cells across the years, and I was hurting. And I remember a few years ago, I was in New Zealand and I heard this Share CD by a guy called Greg P, who wrote The Triangle of Self-Obsession. And in his Share, he says, you know, I'm not sure that I came here with an honest desire to stop using. My most honest desire was one to stop hurting. And actually, that's how I was born into 12-step recovery, was I was just in a blistering amount of spiritual pain. And it was just like anything, like Kitty described, anything not to go back. That terror of that lifestyle remains with me almost a decade into the journey. I see it and I relate to it, and it feels like it was almost yesterday. But anything not to go back. And that's how I felt. And I wrote a letter emphasising this to my father. I was homeless when I was in prison, and I sat in cell R418, and I wrote this letter saying, Dad, I've got a rehab, and I could get tagged out of here, and I've got nowhere to go. Can I come to your place? And I swear down, I'm going to be good. We're going to eat vegetables and watch EastEnders, and it's going to be rosy. And you know, I speak light, but I meant it. It was real sincere intention in that letter. And what happened was, started to get out towards the gate, and the obsession came on, and I had no idea what a mental obsession was until I came to these rooms. But the obsession came on, that one idea that overrules all the other ideas: you deserve a beer. You've worked really hard on that sentence, and you deserve one. You deserve one. What problem is that? And I got a can. In fact, I got a 4-pack. I drank it really quickly. I was in a black cab. I was in Hoxton scoring. I overdosed, I missed my tag date, all sorts of just madness. You know, luckily I still got the tag, but I stayed at my father's for a few weeks, and I was into probably, I'd had all sorts of layers of desperation, but this was purely now using against my will. Because I was using, it wasn't really working, so I categorised it as just more duff, trod-on gear, even though my mate was absolutely off his face on my mattress. It's just not working for me. I was disgusted. I was in my little brother's bedroom, hiding needles between comics. I was literally, I just felt vulgar and I felt crass. And there was a speaker I heard in this meeting a long time ago who said, you know, it's like your morality is just descending faster than you can lower your standards. And that's where I was. That's where I was. And I could look myself in the mirror and I hated what I saw. And I just felt so chronically defeated, which is perfect for a man with an ego like mine, because it meant that when I finally got into treatment, I was a mess, I was chaotic, I was on a long protracted Valium detox, I held syringes in my back pocket throughout the first 6 weeks of my detox, I stockpiled Valium, I was, you know, behaving just outrageously and going to every group and going, yeah, it's awful out there, I can't wait for this new life, and, you know, just really, really desperately holding on in case it didn't go my way. And I went on to a secondary care unit in London. I was terrified of coming back to London. All the really grey, gritty chaos I knew was in London, and so I was pretty convinced that even though they wanted me to come back here, the idea of coming back here meant I was probably going to use again, and that terrified me. And it never came true. I came and I sat in a halfway house down in South London, and the main blessing in there was that I was in a house with 24 or so extraordinary men, people that were desperate not to use. And there was all sorts of mad behaviour in there, don't get me wrong, but I encountered a few other guys who really, really wanted recovery and were getting bridged across into the rooms of NA, AA, etc. And I started coming to NA, and I feel very lucky that I was in that situation, because when I first got here, I came with a mate who just seemed to love it. He was flying. He was like doing 14, 15 meetings a week, anything to get out of the house and get involved with what was going on here. I came in and was like, wow, you lot are mental. What's this language you're talking? It doesn't bear any relation to the stuff I was hearing a minute ago at Old Street Roundabout or in the hostels on the Hackney Road. You lot sound deranged. And you're all chewing gum and it looks nuts. And then there was God and what? Even though I was praying in my prison cell, the minute you mentioned God, I'm a bit like, oh God, it's that lot. And then it was like, is this a cult? Are you going to invite me into a cult? That's weird. Who's the leader here? And slowly, slowly, I edged my way into here. There was a Monday meeting in St. Giles. There was this larger-than-life artist that used to host that meeting. And he was wicked. He was naughty. He's also gone now, unfortunately. God rest his soul. He was a lively spirit, though. And the most attractive thing about him was that he spoke freely about a chaotic life, and he extended a very generous spirit of fellowship. He invited a whole crew of us down to coffee shops, and we'd all go down and engage in our little cynical bits of humour and pull apart the system and all that stuff. But there was a feeling of camaraderie, and suddenly I felt like I'd arrived somewhere where potentially there was a bit of freedom. Ian mentioned earlier hospitals and institutions, and I'd heard the message through hospitals and institutions, and I remember getting this feeling that, wow, they sound like they've come from somewhere similar to where I'm coming from. I still know I'm different to them, but they sound similar to me, and it looks like they found a way out, and if they have, I want it. And that for me was the first inkling of step two coming to light in my recovery. And then when I got to London and I landed in that Monday night meeting where there was a really strong sense of camaraderie, unity and fellowship, I was like, I might just stay around here. There's a few other heads like me and they make me feel safe. And I don't feel safe when I'm on my own. I desperately wanted to be on my own. I hated being in treatment. After 3 months, I was just surrounded by these nutty blokes drinking hell of a lot of coffee and going to the gym and eating grotesque amounts of food, and just wanted to get out. I wanted to get out. And by the time I did get out, I discovered the root of my problem. It says in the literature, the most abnormal thing an addict can do is not use drugs. when I left rehab, for some reason, that kind of unity of purpose in the rehab and being around a load of other people in really early recovery was really soothing. It was really healing. As soon as I was out on my own, wandering the streets, or I used to do the helpline service and wander down to this meeting when it was in the port cabins, I felt like an alien in my own skin. I just felt so weird. It was so hallucinogenic. And then I met Dudley one time when he was doing a chair here. He took me for a cup of tea over there. And I'd experienced like the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. And I just suddenly defrost from all that sense of alienation and suddenly feel like, oh, I can breathe. And I started to get really hooked into what it is we do here, that unity of purpose and that people coming together for the sole reason to get another day clean. It's a very pure thing that we engage with here, and it works on many, many levels, I think. And what happened for me was I left rehab, I was hanging out with my best mate, my roommate from rehab, and I felt dead scratchy in abstinence. I felt wrong. I felt really, really tied up in knots. I didn't know how to articulate fear, how to tell you I was riddled with resentment and I didn't even know it. All of this stuff was just bubbling and cooking away inside of me, and I guess the core of what I suffer from is self-obsession, right? And that's what I was using to escape from, and there it was revealing itself in abstinence 6-7 months in. Wow, my head was a mess. And that led to me reaching out in a really protracted, convoluted, ugly way. But I reached out and got some help from a sponsor who I'm still with to this day. We've been through thick and thin, hell and back sort of journey. And it's been beautiful. And one of the most beautiful things was engaging with that 4 and 5 and experiencing... they describe it in the literature, you know, I'm a massive advocate of the steps. They describe it as being a turning point in one's journey. And it felt like the linchpin of becoming connected to the human race. And I'm still frail, I'm still inadequate, I've got loads of weird phobias, I get angry about the oddest shit, but I'm connected. You know, today I was with my goddaughter, I did a bit of rock climbing with a load of lads I've never met before from Spain, and I'm out there living now and able to connect to that life on a very emotive, authentic level, and that's some of the priceless qualities. But I just go back to talk more about the entrance into this arena. And I got service, I was doing the helpline and I was working my step 4. It took me a while, I put the pen down loads of times, and I worked studiously through the steps. I was reaching out, I was helping other people, I was going into detoxes and prisons by the time I was a year. Like I said, I was on that helpline, and then I started to experiencing attempts to sponsor other men and how that lifted me in ways I couldn't describe to you here and now, and started to feel connected and engaged with this process that, if I'm honest, I still get cynical about, and I still get dismissive of, and I still underestimate and devalue and pull it apart and put it back together again. They say you're entitled to a God of your own understanding. And for me, that's been a really difficult rite of passage. I've formed ideas, I've invested all my belief and faith into them, only to dismiss them and say, no, 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 that ain't right, that doesn't work for me now. And I've had to continuously develop my recovery because my illness is progressing. And I know that. I got to 5 years clean. And I'd had quite a radical journey, you know. I'd got involved in some really interesting stuff. Suddenly the illness ambushed me. It had just taken shape in a whole other area. And it frightened the life out of me. I was just chronically obsessed. And I could not break the cycle of obsession. And it was grinding my spirit down. It was isolating me from the rooms. And a dear, dear soul, a dear friend of mine who's quite ahead of me in the journey said, you need to go get more help. I was like, oh, saying, not this again. Sitting in a load of rooms, a load of weirdos, talking a load of stuff I don't really understand. And the commitment, the humility, the ongoing willingness and perseverance to do so, to re-engage with another process of steps, to look at how this illness... Because when I first come here, and people are like, it's like having 2 pots and 3 lids, or even...
You've got this disease called addiction, but the narcotics were just a symptom.
Yeah, maybe for you. Narcotics was the issue for me. And what happened was, you know, I got by on that. I went around with some really militant, hard-stepping 12-steppers, and we marched for a really disingenuous 5 years, and then something happened. I hit a rock bottom, I hit a load of trauma, and I just had to get real and go, bloody hell. What I was doing yesterday ain't helping me today. I need to dig deep, and I need to do more, and I need to discover another level of honesty. I need to let people into the really hideous nooks and crannies that I'm not really prepared to. I've got intimacy issues. I've got to like, suddenly go, oh, God, there's this. And the other bloke going, yeah, me too. Oh, really? And that whole process of trust and faith and belief being reinvigorated and do some more writing, self-investigation. Oh, there's that. And oh, no, that, really? And all of that stuff. And what's happened is I went through that process and it was dark, it was traumatising. It was like experiencing, I was an opiate freak, and it was like withdrawing it was like experiencing the withdrawals from opiates, but without any chemicals to place it on. It was like, wow, I'm obsessed, I'm climbing the walls, I can't sleep, I'm restless, irritable, discontent, I'm all of this stuff. And I got held, I got helped, and I got enlightened. Really, really quickly, that experience came to serve a few people around me. I was like, oh, that's what that was about. Oh, okay. And the God's will dimension of this stuff is exciting. It's inviting. It's something I can never fully wrap my head around because it's always revealing a little bit more. And I think the most important thing of that experience in my fifth year was how it served as a lifeline to both my best friend from rehab and a sponsee, and managed to pull them through what looked like equal levels of trauma. And we kind of, you know, bunch of guys in it together, yeah, me too, kind of stuff. Earl Hightower talks about his sponsor, Donald Madden, being two addicts in the trenches, sharing their experience, strength and hope. And you know, beyond the steps, beyond the literature, I think the power of empathy and compassion and caring that we share here, because that terror that was described earlier of going back to the lifestyle, I now attach that to not just myself, but my friends. I've had dear friends relapse in here, and I've had to drag them out the gullies and detox them in my room, and I've seen people turn it around again in here. And I've got another mate who's facing like a life sentence, but he's just out there tearing himself to pieces, and it kills me, it destroys me. He's got a daughter, he's got his own lovely family, and he's got his own illness, and he's got his own journey. And yeah, so sorry, a bit of a tangent. Sponsorship, helping others, I think the most potent thing that experience at year five, or going through the process of steps and communicating to others, now is your time to jack. This is when you go out and help the lives of others. That's, for me, been one of the most revealing things of how, still to this day, I like to get really, really knotted up in self-obsession, whether it's around money, women, work. I get really, really into making myself miserable, basically. And when I help others, it just gives me, you know, in the step three prayer, it's like, relieve me of the bondage of self, and all paths lead to service. And when I engage with true acts of service, I get a little bit of relief. In the Mother Fellowship, it says in the literature, we live with minds designed to manufacture misery. Yep. And I also know that sometimes I'll get a phone call, I'll be like, oh, not this, not now. Watching this really good movie, why have we got to do this? And I answer that phone and I talk to him, we spend half an hour, and he'll tell me about a bit of relationship trauma or the life of his newborn or anything, and we share and we live and we learn, and it's like, wow, you know what just happened in that moment in time where I was so resistant. And that's what I've learned, is I'm deeply self-centred, deeply selfish, and I really, really want to resist the stuff that's good for me. And it's priceless, the stuff that's good for me. I carried the message into mental institutions, and And I learned so much about myself through doing that. And I think the act and the art of helping others, the stuff that has been revealed to me through the process and steps, is also the thing that links me and keeps me deeply connected to this stuff, because I still live with a mind that wants to disconnect. A friend of mine, Mark, says it's like we live with hearts that yearn connection but minds that desire isolation, and I come here for that tribal sense of unity and that collective thing. Because what happens when I came here and I connected with you odd lot of strangers was that I went back through the amends, I went marching into my family and started to rebuild and nurture and develop rapport and relations with them. It took time. It's still a bit crusty with my mum, but there was something I really wanted to share here, which was after going through all that stuff in my fifth year, actually, I come out the other side of that, and I was a bit more mellowed out by it. I was somehow just a bit more in touch with how sensitive, soft, vulnerable I can be. And one night I was out, I was in a band at the time, I was doing a gig, and I got this phone call from my mum. She's an alcoholic, she was off her head, she was screaming at me, a load of nonsense, and turns out, through the nonsense, she admits, "Oh, I'm losing my dad." I was like, wow, okay, this conversation's kind of dark and awkward, and you said a load of really unruly, nasty stuff, and I'm hurt, I'm resentful, I need to put the phone down. And then I reached out. Stuff I learned here primarily. I reached out, and my little brother was like, "Oh, I don't feel right about that." And I've just like pretty much dismissed mum when she's saying she needs my help and she's losing her father, and I just can't talk to her when she's like that. And he's like, "Did you think about talking to our auntie? She's sane and normal and, you know, a bit of a light." And I was like, no, I hadn't. I was so focused on the dysfunction of mine and my mum's rapport, it just didn't even occur to me. And so I reached out to my auntie. "Hello, Kate. So I'm sorry to hear about what's going on. What can I do?" And she was like, "Oh, you'd be in love if you come out here with your mum." And I was like, "Oh, God. Anything but that?" And so I jumped in a car with my mum the next day, and she was really at her wit's end, and we had this really frustrating drive out into the country to this mad... He was in a hospice by then. It was in this old mansion out in Reading. And I remember feeling like really, really weirdly protective of her as other drivers were giving her a bit of road rage and stuff. I just like felt this weird paternal kind of protective thing going on. And we got to the hospice and we went upstairs and I heard my grandpa in his death throes, his alcoholism had ended him and his kidneys were failing, and it was bleak and pretty grotty. And we went up into this upper floor of the building. I could hear him doing like death rattly moany sort of stuff. And everything inside of me was like, "Oh, I can't do this. This is mental." And my mum was like, "You're right." "Yeah, I'm fine." And we went into this family room and I was like, "I don't know if I can go in there at the minute. I'm just going to do a jigsaw." And I grabbed this jigsaw puzzle box and I'm walking around this family room. I don't even know how to open the box, let alone do the puzzle. And I just sit down feeling really perplexed and puzzled. And then next thing I know, my little brother's come marching in and he's flown from the other side of the world to be there. And I looked at him and he looks equally as perplexed as me. And "Are you all right?" He's like, "I can't do it." I was like, "Neither can I." And so we sat down together, and then our mum come like running in, and my amends had felt so ineffectual with her. She was like, "Yeah, don't worry about it, let's not talk about that." And she come running in and she looked all like really like a petrified rabbit. And I was like, "You okay?" And she was like, yeah, I'm fine. "I'm just going to go outside and have a quick cigarette." I'm like, yeah, you do that. Go outside, have a ciggy, sort yourself out. And something really deep, really on a conscience level, the stuff I would find really hard to hear, the God's will sort of stuff, something just leapt out from in me. Was like, "That wasn't right. You sounded like your dad." And I was like, "Oh, Mum, is there anything you need from me?" And she was like, no, I'm fine. I was like, "Can I just give you a hug?" And then we stood there, we embraced, and she shook in my arms. And I was like, it was really surreal again, like that thing where you're just watching yourself and like, wow, who's driving this at the minute? It ain't me. and just stood there, held her. And then off the back of that, I had the courage to go in and say goodbye to my grandfather. And I went and sat by his bed, held his cold, clammy hand, looked at his yellow face. The next thing I see is my brother comes and sits opposite me. And he's plucked up the courage to come and be there. And I got all envious. He was a bit better with my granddad than I was. And I was even envious of my granddad having all this family around him. And just sat there and held his hand. And we were there with him. And we were unified. And our aunties watched over us and gave him a kiss, said my goodbye. And I went out and I was with my brother that night. And we lost him that night. And it felt magic. It felt beyond any language. It was just so familial. It felt like real love. It felt like, despite their dysfunction, despite their neuroses, I was there, I was serving a purpose, I was giving away freely what I'd acquired through these rooms. Thanks, Dean. And what I guess I've learnt across the passage of time in here is I'm still mad, I'm still obsessive, I still want isolation, but I also have the power of unconditional love that I've learned through service, that I've learned through the step work, underneath all that writing, all that written work that I resisted and hated doing and resented these people making me do this writing about this stuff. Underneath all of that, there's this unconditional love, a code of love and tolerance that, if you want to carry it into all your affairs, probably will make your life quite a bit better. And that's been my experience. I'm, like I said, selfish, self-centred, self-obsessive, still to this day. But every now and then I get the opportunity to extend love, tolerance, patience, forgiveness into my affairs. And what happens is I can never predict, or I always underestimate, the power of this stuff. I'm a million times better brother to my little brother, who's also like a best mate to me. Chronically dysfunctional alcoholic and mad little drug addict, but I'm there for him, and we hang out, we chat, we do time together. And my role within my family really is the most important thing. But you know, like today, I'm looking for a career change. I'm kind of thinking quite a lot about that. I had this chair to do this evening, and it's kind of like, oh God, what we're going to say, and how's that going to go, and what they're going to think of me. And I thought, oh God, just go for a climb. Forget about thinking for the minute. Just go and unwind. And then I went on to see my goddaughter, and she was like showing off her drawing and stuff. And it was just like, wow. Wow. When people say that awful expression of life beyond your wildest dreams, God, it makes me want to tear my skin off. But I think if I had to re-articulate it, what I've learnt here is how to live in my own skin, how to connect with other human beings, how to express myself, how to hear others, help them to feel understood, to demonstrate empathy, to live with qualities that internally, I don't know about you lot, but when I used to use and shoot up and stuff, I just think, I just don't get me, I'm a bloody good guy. No shit, I am. Underneath all of the illness, the malaise, the dysfunction, the extraordinary weirdness that I possess, there's a really good essential soul. And that is being gleaned through my engagement with the process of 12-step recovery. I'm still weird around the word God. I'm still kind of like, oh, service. And, you know, I just do it. I just come here and I do this stuff because it's priceless. My relationships, my friends don't look anything like the relationships I had before discovering recovery. The way I consider the lives of others has transformed. So, well, life beyond the wildest dream stuff is that I just have had a paradigm shift. I think and look at life differently on a material level. It ain't what I want still. There's still a lot lacking in my life. There's still, I want this career change. I'd like a relationship. I still feel destitute around love. But there's the spirit of service and the forgiveness and the compassion that this program's taught me, and how I've extended that into my life, into the weirdly intimate relations, whether it be friends and family. That's what I would call the quality of recovery. There was this thing when I was in that treatment centre, it was like, We get to witness our recovery through the way we relate to the world, or words along them like, oh, I used to read it. Or our recovery shines in the way we relate to others. And now, I guess that's principally what I've learned, is a new code of conduct, a better way or behaving in a way in which I felt I always wanted to or desired to, but just felt so enslaved by active addiction that I couldn't express myself, I couldn't connect to you, I couldn't give you what I wanted to, and now I possess a better ability to do so. And so it's a great gift to come here and chat a bit of rubbish into this microphone. I hope it's helped someone. Welcome to all the newer people. Please keep coming. It's truly magic what we get up to in these rooms, and I'll leave it there.